August 6, 2008.
The overwhelming majority of Jews in Lithuania were not Shomer Shabbos between after the turn of the century. Things were very, very bad. Perhaps even as bad as they are in America today. So it's a myth. One of the basic myths which they feed, which we feed ourselves. I guess would be the way to put it, but it's not true. My grandfather went to visit Warsaw in 1938. He lived in Switzerland, and he wrote a letter to friends of his in Lithuania. He was originally from Lithuania, and he said in Warsaw there were 40 Jewish restaurants, one of which you could eat for sure, and one of which maybe you could eat, and the other 38 you couldn't eat. Okay, so that means that
it's worse than some places here.
Yeah, that's right. So probably there was some proportion there. I mean, that means that Jewish restaurants, one out of 40 was okay. So that's 2.5%. That's pretty low. Yeah. Because the school system, the main problem was that the educational system either collapsed or was non-existent. By that I mean that there was no, well, we discussed this in the, when we talked about women, there was no education at all for women, and education for boys, to the extent that it existed, was a haphazard, informal affair, the cheder system. So the organizational skills of the German Jews who followed the footsteps of Schaus, Paul Hirsch, Ezreal Hildesheimer, and others, who came to Eastern Europe during World War I when the Germans conquered Poland and Lithuania, they laid the groundwork for a modern educational system for Lithuanian and Polish Jewry, which was able to save whoever was they were able to save in the period between the wars. And without that educational system, nobody would have survived. It's important to know that even though there were great yeshivas in Lithuania, there were tremendous, awesome yeshivas in Lithuania and in Poland, they catered to relatively small segments of the population. Like you said before, they're very Shlomo, right?
Yeah.
Shlomo said before that there's never been a time with so many people learning Torah like today. In Lithuania, the big yeshivas, well, okay, 400 people, which is nice and big, but doesn't compare to Lakewood or the Mir. So in reality, you had the small elite, which was in the yeshiva world, and the great masses were ignorant and were sometimes not observant either. So the yeshivas were the reason why the impression is skewed is because in yeshivas we relate the history of yeshivas, and therefore we come away with the impression that everything was rosy and glorious. But in fact, in the yeshivas it was pretty good, but outside the yeshivas there was devastation. The assimilation was rampant. Incredible. Yeah.
Why is it common knowledge that in Germany there was mass assimilation, or in Lithuania it doesn't seem like most people know that, they think it was flourishing? Like, why is there a difference between what people think of Germany and what they think of Lithuania?
Well, part of it too with the intrinsic disdain with which the Eastern Europeans view the Western Europeans. Okay, that's part of it. Another part of it is reform and conservative. That is very, since as Rabbi Tamer mentioned to me, this is really a course in Jewish history, masquerade is a course in Navi. I guess that this is important to know into for a moment, which is sorry, Rabbi Tamer, I didn't know if you wanted that so explicit. But in any event, it is the genius of Orson Matt to kill two birds with one stone, right? Called Navi and teach history. Okay, in Israel today, there are secular Jews and Orthodox Jews. There are almost no Reform and Conservative Jews, right? There's a big difference. A secular Jew knows that Reform and Conservative are non-authentic. In other words, the shul which he doesn't daven at is an Orthodox shul. Right? So that's, but the Reform and Conservative, they smell, this is not really authentic Judaism. The same thing was true in Lithuania. In Lithuania, there were secular Jews and there were Orthodox Jews. There was no Reform and Conservative movement. Again, the shul I didn't daven in was an Orthodox shul. In Germany, Reform and Conservative was real, and more Reform than Conservative. Conservative came later, but more Conservative is almost a uniquely American phenomenon. But Reform was real and powerful and a majority. So therefore, there came up, since there was this alternative movement, they created the impression that in Germany there is a Reform movement, and then there is Orthodoxy, which is an embattled minority. Whereas since in Lithuania and Poland, there was no alternative movement. There was just, you know, leaving the fold. So therefore, there was it didn't create in certain people's minds the conception, the perception that there was actually, you know, this kind of falling away. Because again, there was no movement to which these people affiliated or belonged. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
Yeah.
I have just two questions. The first question is...
Just two?
Actually, there's more coming, but now it's two.
Okay, yeah.
How come today there's yeshivas that allow boys to go to college and learn the trade? In Europe, the yeshiva system was just learn a whole day.
Because the yeshiva serves a different purpose in America than it did in Europe. In Europe, the yeshiva was meant to educate the elite. We spoke about this.
Oh.
In America, the yeshiva system is meant to keep people from. And since that's the case, at least some yeshivas have to provide for the people who are not going to be the educated, the great elite of the next generation. So they provide for them by having all sorts of programs which you might not find if you were just training the Gedolei Hador for the next generation.
Also, why is it in European history you see like a lot of intermarriage, especially in the 1900s, the time of Greco-Roman time era, where you had Hellenism, you don't have too many people either intermarrying or becoming Hellenists. Why was that?
Because the bulk of Jewry, the world Jewry was still in the land of Israel. So there weren't too many shiksas to marry.
Oh.
Right? It only was when they spread out when there actually became much more assimilation.
Oh, so that's right.
Yeah.
You said prior to the mid-19th century that at the mid-19th century is when, you know, people became, kind of like you were saying, started to become not shops. Was there a time before that? When, you know, throughout the Middle Ages or wherever in Europe, when the majority of the Jews were shalmachops?
Yeah. There was no exciting alternative, nor was there any social pressure to change, because outside society was also frum, but they were frum Christians, which is a much less appealing frumkeit than Judaism.
Mm-hmm.
So,
And so... Was there much assimilation going on like throughout the generations in Europe? I mean, we European Jews look somewhat more European than at least, you know, ancient Israelis.
I don't think it was so much assimilation. No, it's the other way around. There were conversions, and that's what made people, you know, look blonde and light hair. So it's not people entered the fold. It's not so much leaving the fold. So the Jews generally assimilate only when times are good. So, and that's like in Spain before the expulsion, there was a lot of assimilation. And in Europe, as things were getting better in the mid 19th century and on, there was a lot of assimilation. But before that, there was very little. Anything else I didn't have that before? Yeah.
Actually, I'm before there, Eric, you mentioned regarding the education, but how did like working
that
whole revolution?
No, it's not the working aspect.
Oh.
It means that the secular training. But because in order, until the late 19th century, generally speaking, if you could make a decent living, and really you didn't have that much of an alternative by being a farmer, a cobbler, a blacksmith, a store owner, right? There were no such things as accountants. Very few lawyers, right? They didn't exist. But in the late 19th century, as the Eastern Europe became more urban, and as the economy became more modernized, they were, all of a sudden, the good jobs required secular education. And until the Torah Derech Eretz type schools arose to provide the secular education, the only place you could get that was in a non-Jewish institution. So that would lead very often to all sorts of pressures and all sorts of actually aspirations to become assimilated. Okay. Yeah.
In my understanding, I guess I'm wrong, but the Enlightenment really didn't reach Eastern Europe like it did Western Europe. Is that not correct?
It reached it later.
Okay.
Actually, there was a... I don't know if it ever reached... let's make this clear. It didn't reach ever the Russian peasants. Right? The Russian peasants remained Russian peasants, and they probably remain Russian peasants to this very day. Right? That we're not talking about the... What do you call Russia? There's a word for them.
Mujik.
Okay, so they remain the same thing to this day. The Jews were the elite, first of all, Russians, in St. Petersburg and lesser extent in Moscow. They were influenced by the West. And if you know your Tolstoy, as a matter of fact, the educated Russians spoke in French among themselves. But that also didn't have much to do with the Jews, because the Jews were not a part of that society. But among the Jews themselves, in the mid-19th century, there arose a movement called the Haskalah movement. The Haskalah movement was brought about by an influx of German-Jewish intellectuals who wanted to save the Eastern European Jews from the morass of ignorance, of, you know, secular ignorance, and they're being mired in their backward ways, and therefore they came to try and spread the light of enlightened modern thought. There became two types of, and this, the Haskalah movement, Haskalah means intelligence, the Haskalah movement had two distinct ramifications. One ramification was that the certain people became non-Orthodox because they wanted to pursue an education, a liberal education, and all the ideas which were in vogue at the time, and this is a very idealistic period of human history. There also became within the Orthodox camp a certain degree of Frum Haskalah, which exists to this very day. The Frum Haskalah means that, you know, you're aware of perhaps the Greek and Latin origin of words in the Talmud, you know something about the flora and fauna in the Talmud, which most yeshiva bachurim don't really care about. So the that Frum Haskalah continues to exist. The general Haskalah movement, it really doesn't exist anymore, because there is the world which we live in, the general world is a very non-intellectual world. Nobody's into intellectual pursuits anymore. So therefore, the Jews aren't either. So someday, they're probably, one of my bosses at art school once said to me that he anticipates that someday there's going to be a backlash, and there's going to be a modern Haskalah movement, because since the yeshivas nowadays don't provide very profound intellectual stimulation outside Kabbalah, of course, so then someday people are going to rediscover it, and are going to be enticed by that intellectual knowledge and those intellectual pursuits which exist out there. I don't think he's right. I think people have stopped thinking for good. There ain't no turning back. But, okay, well, he's certainly entitled to his opinion.
He's hoping his sales are going to go back up.
What?
He's hoping his sales are going to go back.
So,
I
see you guys really like learning Nach. Okay.
For centuries, though, hasn't Judaism just been, like, entrenched in ignorance, with the vast majority of people just ignorant? I mean, like, even before the Middle Ages, I mean, people were knowledgeable. My understanding is that people were knowledgeable in, like, things that directly related to them. They knew how to, like, make a mock. They, like, personally how to make a mock. They understood, like, what they had to do once the shogun came to their farm, shefted the animals, and left. But, like, in terms of, like, other things, they were, like, they just didn't have, right?
Right. You never had a generation of Jews which was so knowledgeable, at least Orthodox Jews, as today. There's the most knowledgeable generation in Jewish history. But since the time of the first Beit HaMikdash.
Well, in one way, because there's two types of intelligence.
That's a bard school.
There's two types of intelligence. So there's one of, like, knowing, like...
How to get me a ring.
There's one of, like, knowing how to bake your own matzahs at home, knowing how to do shkita, knowing how to, like, take the blood out of basa. But, like, nobody knows that today. As educated as everyone here is, I don't think there's more than 10 people in London that, like... Really, like...
True. The practical knowledge of Judaism has become diminished. But the theoretical knowledge of Judaism is much greater than it used to be. So it's, you know, when it's talking about the United States strive for truth, you know, when we talk about the United States, 100 years ago, 150 years ago for sure, strive for truth would be considered like the deeper secrets of the Torah, you know. So who had access to that kind of stuff? And today, that's ABC. So things have, in that respect, things have vastly improved.
But didn't they hide some of the Kabbalah by chapter 3? I heard they hid some of the Kabbalah stuff.
Yeah, but that they hid it from the small, relatively small group which had it. They made it even more exclusive. But it wasn't a large group. There was never a large group involved in Kabbalistic ideas.
What about Spain?
What about Spain?
You know, like, 1492
Spain. There was an educated elite, but the masses were not particularly educated. It was not like it is today. The closest precedent which we have to today is 19th century Germany. Because 19th century Germany, they were producing, you know, reams and reams and reams of Jewish literature and Jewish periodicals and things like that. But that's the only precedent which we have, and that's in the recent past. Yeah. You have to have access to mass printing in order to be able to do this. In the time when books had to be handwritten, there was no mass access to knowledge. And even when books that were printed, but in a very rudimentary way, there was no way to do this. You had to have the Industrial Revolution in order to be able to have massive access to text and to knowledge. Yeah.
What was the definition of an Amharic, the
Tanoim
and
Amorim?
Like, when they say
about Amharic
and
the
Gemara,
what the big Machlokas, among the Tanoim and Amorim, what's considered to be an
Amharic? Really?
Yeah.
But it's like, because I thought at one point, maybe even though we are the Moran generation, that I thought still, like, even still, but like the fact that we have this abundance and of Torah and the spread of the Torah, the way it's come around the world, that we actually might not be qualified, according to me, their standards or their definition of Amhar, because of, like, the different Torah knowledge we have.
So, I mean, we have no far fewer Amharasim today.
Yeah.
It's quite possible.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
As far as, like, this generation, throughout the ages, what kind of knowledge did the Jews have? Did they learn Flemish, or what did they actually learn, if anything?
Well, there were in each town in, say, Eastern Europe, this is true even in Sephardic countries in many places, there were different levels of knowledge among the tradesmen and the artisans and the farmers. Communities had a chevra shas, which would learn actually Gemara, a chevra mishnayis, which would learn mishnayis, a chevra tehillim, which would just say tehillim. So the people were trying to do whatever they could, but it was generally considered to be a rarity that a balabas, a person who was a layperson, would be learning Gemara. Certainly in depth. As a matter of fact, there was a sefer which is today almost extinct, which is the Ein Yaakov. The Ein Yaakov is a compilation of all of the Agadahs, all of the stories and non-halachic material in Gemara, which was much more popular among the masses than Gemara itself, which has these long and boring discussions. The fact that people learn Daf Yomi today, people learn Daf Yomi, is an amazing, amazing revolution. So that was not taking place in Europe. What is a nach? Anyway. Both of you have spars. We are in Shofim, actually. And we are...
I don't even know what to label this year.
that makes me happy when you have a problem. That's that. We're in the middle of the fifth parak. And we talked about the critique of the tribe that should not come to fight the war against Sisera. And we're up to page Ayin Aleph, Pasuk Chaf Aleph. And it said when they went to war, it said that the armies of Sisera were swept away by Nachal Kishon, the Kishon River. Nachal Kedumim, an ancient river, Nachal Kishon is the river of Kishon. Tidrichi Nafshi Oz, may my soul step it on the powerful enemies of our nation, the Canaanites. And we mentioned already before, I'm not going to speak about it again, that there is a parallel between the chariots of Egypt, which were 600 in number, and the chariots of Sisera, which were 900 in number, and the chariots of Egypt were swept away by the Red Sea, and the chariots of Sisera were swept away by the Kishon River. Just very briefly, there's a symbolism here. The power and might of the non-Jews is swept away by the water, which symbolizes Torah. So therefore, Hashem very often uses water in order to eliminate evil. So much so that Titus, when God set up a tidal wave, which is going to sink his ship as he was on the way back from the destruction of Jerusalem, so Titus said, oh, this God only has power in the water. And that's why he always attacks people with water. And so Hashem, that was a pretty smart move on Titus's part to say that, because he didn't drown. Hashem let him come up on the land, and then he died a slow and torturous death over the course of several years. So the point is that the symbolism here, where the enemies of the Jewish people are destroyed by water. There's another symbolism which Reb Sada brings down, which is that water is represents in taiva, desire. Fire represents anger or zealotry, and water represents desire or lust. We know that the salient bad trait of the Canaanites was their immorality and their lusty behavior. So therefore, their being drowned in water is also a symbol of them, so to speak, getting punished with that which they themselves were afflicted. The Egyptians and Canaanites were very related in this respect. They're also, I think, biologically related, that they were both nations which represent great lust and desire, and water, which represents that lust and desire, is what takes hold of them and punishes them and destroys them. Okay, let's go on to the next pasuk. Pasuk HaBeit. Az hamu ikvei sus. Then removed the hoofs of the horses. Midaros daros abirov. From the galloping, the the spurrings on of the knights, or of the horsemen of Sisera and his armies. So they spurred them on very quickly to try and get them to pursue the Jews and destroy them. But in fact, what happened was that they were led themselves down to their own doom, where then they were swept away from the waters of the Kishon River. Then in Pasuk Chav Gimel, she says a very strange thing. She says, Oru Meiroz, Amar Melech Hashem. Cursed is Meiroz, said the agent of Hashem. Oru Oru Yoshvel, accursed are its inhabitants. Ki Rabo Ezes Hashem, Bagiborim, because they didn't come to the assist God with his warriors who are fighting against the armies of Sisera. So this pasuk, I left out a pasuk at the beginning. Sorry, pasuk chaf we didn't do yet. Chaf aleph is important to learn. Chaf gimel relates back to chaf. Take a look at chaf. He says. It says there that minashamayim yochamu akochavim mimsilosam, from the heavens the stars fought from their pathways. Yochamu imsisua, they fought with Sisera. We did the Zeus pasuk, but yesterday, the day before, whatever. But the point is that according to Rashi here, Meiroz is one of the stars, and it didn't come to help the Jews. And it came, in other words, the inhabitants of this star, Meiroz, are being cursed by Dvora, by the emissary of God, for not having come to assist the Jews in their battles against Sisera. So from here, Rabbi Aryeh Kaplan brings evidence that there is a strain of belief in Judaism in extraterrestrial life. And this extraterrestrial life, which existed on Meiroz, they should have come along with the rest of the extraterrestrials and fought against Sisera and his army. Since they didn't fight against Sisera and his army, so therefore, Dora curses them. Now, this is not the only interpretation of this problem. The Rashi brings down himself a different shot that Meiroz was a city on Earth, not some star or planet somewhere up in the sky. But that's not the point. The point is that here you see that there is a legitimacy to the assumption or to the belief that there are people or entities which exist on other planets. Now, I don't know either way, and I'm not taking sides in this, but there are from time to time meet people who are adamant in the assumption that according to Judaism there can be no extraterrestrial life, and this is false. This goes against, of course, an explicit pasuk in Shofti. There are those who say, and I think Rabbi Kaplan is among them, and I don't understand it, that only we have free will, not extraterrestrials. In other words, free will is a uniquely human trait, and it's uniquely human because humans control all of the destiny of the universe, of the totality of the universe. And therefore we have free will, but no other entity does. This is difficult from this pasuk, because in this pasuk it seems that we're cursing the people of Meiroz for deciding not to come to war. And if they don't have free will, it's not really fair to curse them, right? It's not their fault that they didn't come. So therefore it seems to indicate that they do have free will. Yeah? What about the ones, the fish at the very bottom of the sea?
The effect of the ecology of the sea. They affect something on our planet.
So maybe these do too. Obviously they do.
I don't.
If that's the only issue which bothers you, So there is an impact. But I don't. According to the Rambam, you know, we don't hold like the Rambam, generally speaking. But it's worthwhile bringing it up through the Rambam's issue here. The Rambam doesn't have this anthropocentric view of the world. He doesn't believe necessarily man is the sole purpose of creation. In other words, God is a great artist, because I'll say Ein Tzayor Kelokeinu. There's no artist like Hashem. And a great artist creates great art. And great art isn't necessarily limited to one form of art. So therefore, there can, according to the Rambam, many species or many entities exist as an expression of God's artistry, of God's craft and God's will to produce this incredibly complex and brilliant masterpiece, which is the universe. So there's no reason we need to assume that he didn't create other people or other creatures in other worlds as part and parcel of that. Or is there?
It's weird, that's all. I don't know.
Like,
I'll teach you about this
thing
tomorrow.
Yeah.
It's bothers
you
because
it's weird? I kind of believed it
at one point, but like then I
was
always like, oh, I was
just
stupid. I
was
losing
the
aliens. Like, okay. And I was on the wrong track, you know?
Okay. So there is no definitive proof either way. The fact, because here it's also machlokes in Chazal, or among the commentaries, but it certainly is. It's not contradictory to Judaism to assume that there is. Yeah.
I think the question, you said we don't hold by the Rambam. Does that mean our opinion that we hold by it, that that's the correct answer? What does that mean that we hold by someone if we don't know what the answer is?
It was a mistake. I shouldn't have expressed myself that way. I don't hold what I just said. What I meant is that the mainstream of Jewish thought is not like the Rambam. Certainly, you know, the Rambam is doing anything the Rambam says, by virtue of the fact that it was said by the Rambam, automatically becomes authoritative and legitimate. So we can't argue on the Rambam. We can say the mainstream Jewish thought has taken the position that the creation is indeed anthropocentric. It focuses on man and specifically on Klal Yisrael. Yeah. Okay. So the. So this pasuk, you know, it's interesting. The Rambam writes that the story that there was a famous professor, his name was Professor Zev Lev, film professor, and he founded an institution in Yerushalayim which is called Machon Lev, which is the Jerusalem College of Technology, where a place where people learn half a day and they go for technological expertise in the afternoon. So he had a discussion once with a Rosh Yeshiva, and this Rosh Yeshiva was convinced that there's one of the popular conspiracy theories that the astronauts never landed on the moon, because the Rambam says that the moon is a spiritual entity.
Rambam,
Maimonides. He said it in Torah. Yeah, he says it's an angelic entity, and therefore the way this Rosh Yeshiva and so the Rambam, its mass is not the mass of actual matter, but the mass of some spiritual form of matter. So he said it must be that they never made it to the moon. So the Professor Lev asked him, you know, there's a Rambam which says that you don't now I'll take money to learn in Kolo. What? Now I'll take money to learn in Kolo. So what do you do with that Rambam? They said, okay, that's a difficult Rambam. We don't pass like that Rambam. Which is true, we don't. So Professor Lev said, okay, so this is also a difficult Rambam. We don't pass like this Rambam either. That's one approach. Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky in his Sefer has a different approach. It was also interesting. He says that, you know, when the astronauts landed on the moon, it caused them a crisis of faith. Because he figured if the Rambam could be wrong about this, maybe he's wrong about other stuff as well. And who says if you follow the Rambam, then you're doing the right thing? But as long as you can assume that the Rambam was correct about everything. So then, okay, great about everything. He's obviously authoritative, so we listen to what he says. But once you can demonstrate that the Rambam made a a demonstrable mistake. So then how can you ever rely on the Rambam? So he's 1 second. So then he came up with a Chiddush, which is true, but I don't know if you really have to come on to this. He said that there are parts of Mishneh Torah which are not halachic, which the Rambam put there in order to make up a holistic and complete body of knowledge. And one of them is his the discussion of physics, as he perceived them through his time, which is in Hilchos Yisodei HaTorah. And the fact that the Rambam made a mistake in areas which are not actually halachic is not indicative of making a mistake in areas which are actually halachic, and therefore the Rambam's integrity is not impinged upon by the fact that he took the moon to be a spiritual object opposed to a material one. Yeah?
He gives a distance for how far away the moon is from the earth, and how far the sun is, and how far Jupiter is. I mean, it seems from a reading of that everything out there was actually
from the universe. I think he means that I think when he gives these distances, he means for astronomical calculations.
Right. So then
right.
He obviously believes that they have to be somewhere out there
spinning around. Yeah, but they don't have to be material out there. It could be, you know, green cheese, you know, but it could be something else that doesn't necessarily be actual rock and be some sort of ethereal thing. Yeah.
I don't understand why this particular incident caused such a crisis of faith for Reb Yaakov Kavinetsky. I mean, there's certain instances, like say in a Gemara where two commentators are arguing, say about a historical event, and one person says it's one day and someone says it's another day. One of them has to be wrong, I would assume. So it probably happens all the time that people are wrong. So why is the fact that the Rambam was wrong in this particular case, is it such a major problem for him?
Well, because the Gemara doesn't purport to be a code. It's not a code of Jewish law. It's a record, it's a log of discussions which took place in Bate Medrash.
Okay.
So therefore, okay, you would expect that somebody would be, you know, not necessarily correct. But the Rambam asserted that his code is the code to end all codes. And that what he says is backed by complete authority, and complete correctness, obviously, complete truth. And therefore, it's much more of a problem for him if the Rambam comes out to be making a mistake than if, say, the Machlekes
Gemara. Yeah? The reform, they took out the Kashem Shen that we say in Yiddish Levana, we can't touch the moon, and they took that out because astronauts went to the moon.
I don't think they were thinking Yiddish Levana before that.
Okay.
I'm not so sure they're worried about this.
Okay, so let me just make that point. But people don't actually touch the moon with their feet, because if they touch the moon with their feet will melt. So maybe when the Rambam said about they can't touch it, he meant literally with
I don't understand what the big deal is. 99.99% of humanity ain't ever touching the moon under any circumstances,
mm-hmm.
right? So therefore, I understand what the problem is with the pasuk, or rather the tefillah. Any ochel gavra, you go try to touch the moon, right? It's not happening. So therefore, it never has. I never understood why people got so bothered by that. But yes, I know, I acknowledge that you're right. There are people who got very bothered by that.
Yeah.
It's a mystery to me. Yeah.
From what meaning of the extent that the spiritual entities like in reality or possesses characteristics?
No, in reality. Is there a Rambam Sefer Mazar here, the first line of Rambam?
Yes.
There's not going to be the Frankel set. Down there somewhere, is there a Rambam?
No.
No. That's not that one. That green. No, that's a Mishnah Berurah. What is that?
Yeah.
That's our model. So I believe he says it's completely spiritual, not just that it has spiritual aspects to it.
So you tell the same thing about the sun?
About the sun, I believe so as well, yeah. But nobody's been to the sun, so.
So I mean, gives like heat, so. You know, he says physicality, physical effects of it.
Okay.
And how do we know that necessarily Rambam like held the way we think he actually holds? Like, you know, like, he said that it's spiritual entity. He never said, by the way, I mean this literally, it's spiritual. Like, we might just assume that he said, you know, per se a spiritual entity. But really meant it's a spiritual entity, but it really called it a physical big ball of mat.
Well, let's see. No, it could be you're right. This is what he says. He says, "Kol kochavim agavlim, all the stars and all the spheres, kulam bali nefesh v'deya v'askelim, they all possess a soul and knowledge and intellect. V'hem chayim v'omdim, and they are alive, and they stand u'makirim, and they recognize as mishomar v'cholayolam." He who spoke and created the universe. Kol echav echav, each one of the people, according to his attainments, according to his spiritual height, according to his attainments, mishabchim l'forin, they praise and they give glory, v'yotzim to the Creator, k'mo ha-malachim, like the angels. U'kshem sh'makirim et ha-kodesh baruch hu, just like these heavenly bodies recognize Hashem, kach makirim et ha-atam, so they recognize themselves, and they know and they recognize the angels who are above them. The das hakochavim v'agalgalim muata, the intellect of the stars, the wisdom of the stars and the spheres is less than das hamalachim, than the intellect of angels, ugdolim das meyodam, and greater than that of the of human beings. So right here he doesn't actually say that it is bereft of any physicality. He says that it has a spiritual nature to it as well. Okay, so yeah, could be considered, like you said. Possible? I'm not sure if it says something more explicit somewhere else, but according to what it says here, so that would seem to be the case. So what you're saying could be correct. Shkoyach. Okay.
But Yaakov's question on it.
Yeah, so that's a good question. Now I have to go back and look at Rabbi Yaakov and see why he felt it was a question. Because it seems from here that it's possible to say that it's not a question. It's a good point.
If you call something a sphere, then you're saying it has, like, shape and physicality to it. Then wouldn't you take that as something being a physical item? Perhaps?
Yeah, but before, well, he says about the spheres that they aren't physical, even though they, the heavenly spheres, by spheres he means the ancient astronomers held that there are strips in the sky in which the stars are embedded, and the strips move, and that's why constellations move around. Have you ever been to a planetarium or a museum of astronomy? So the old globes, when they wanted to depict the heavens, were surrounded by strips of metal, some larger, some smaller. Has anybody ever seen that? A globe surrounded by a larger a group of spheres, those are the spheres in which the stars are embedded and they travel. So I'm saying those spheres, though, are not material spheres.
But the description given in the city first. seems to say that they're concentric, meaning they occupy space one within the other.
Right, but he says that enam lo kalim lo kvedim. They're not heavy, nor not light, nor heavy. Seems to indicate they have no mass whatsoever. Anyway, but this, you're right about the moon. It doesn't necessarily say that it doesn't have any mass whatsoever. Okay, so let's go back and we'll see what Rabbi Yaakov says. Let's do one more pasuk. Tzvorach mino shem yoel eshes chever akeni. So Dvorah comes and she blesses, she gives a bracha to Yoel, the wife of Chever HaKeni, Minashim Boel to Tzvorach. And she is great from the women who are in the tent. She'll be more blessed than them. And the question is, Chazal say that she meant to praise Yoel to a greater extent than the Mohs, than the matriarchs, Sar, Rivka, Rachel, and Leah, and that's made Oel from the woes who were in the tent of the Avos, of the forefathers. So the question is, why is Yoel more praiseworthy than the Mohs, which came prior to her? And it would seem that the reason is like this. The reason is that the Rambam says that the reason why the Avos and Moshe Rabbeinu are regarded as so great in our history is because they were able to, at the same time they're involved in mundane activities of this world, to focus in their minds on Hashem. And they were able to have Hashem in front of them at the same time that they were dealing with commercial or social or any other type of mundane matter. That was what made them great. And certainly the Imos, we assume, were of the same level. The Imos were on the level, the mothers on the same level as the matriarchs, as the patriarchs. But there are times when it's much harder to focus on these things. Even though they were focused on it when they were doing optional activities, Yoel was focused on the will of God when she was doing averos, when she was doing sins. Meaning that Yoel, we mentioned in the last chapter, is the paradigm of an avero lishma. Avero lishma means that you're doing a sin for the sake of heaven. And she sinned with Sisera in order to then eventually kill him. And she was focusing not on the pleasure or whatever tuma there is in avero, but the ultimate goal, which was to do something in order to be Mekadesh Shem Shemayim, in order to bring about something which is positive for God in this world. That's very hard, much harder to do. For us, it's well beyond what we are able to do, because it's hard for us to focus on God's will when we're doing optional activities. But Yoel's high madrega was that even when she was doing these an Aveira, she was doing it completely with Shem Shemayim. And that's a very high level, which very few people can actually achieve. And that's why an Avera Lishma is a very dangerous thing. To somebody to say, I want to go and sin for the sake of heaven, is dangerous for many reasons. But one of the most dangerous reasons is because maybe you're fooling yourself. Maybe you're really doing it because you want to do the Avera. It's true, some positive ramification might come out of it, but that's not necessarily your intention. Your intention is to enjoy the sin that you're doing. So therefore, that's why Yoel was so praised, because even though she was doing a sin, which could have been very enjoyable, she was having intimate relations with Sisera. Nevertheless, Devorah testifies, she was doing it completely for the sake of heaven, and that was a very tough and very praiseworthy thing. Yeah?
Wasn't Adam sin for a very lishma?
Yes, but he didn't he entered the sin lishma. But when he did the sin, he didn't do lishma. And once he made a conscious decision, you know what, this is what I should be doing. But once he was in it, that's what Chazal say, that when Hashem asked him, did you eat from it? He said, yeah, achalti v'ochal od. I ate, I'm going to eat more, given the opportunity. Which is very strange. What do you mean, going to eat more? You made a decision to do it. It should be a one-time thing, which you did because you had to do it. But once he got into it, he got swept up by the desire and by the emotion of the sin. So even Adam stumbled in that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now what other examples we have of
very few. Esther is the one, the other one, which is the famous, a famous example. Mm-hmm. Yaakov marrying two sisters, the famous example.
Well,
there are very, but there are very few of them throughout
the history. Why was Yaakov greater than Esther?
What?
Why was Yaakov thing?
Not Esther greater than Esther. But Dvorah didn't say she was greater than Esther. Esther wasn't on the scene yet. She was greater than the Sar, Rivka, Rach, and Leah.
Also, I heard a coin, the
Brisker Rob,
I don't know who it was, but some people
said
that
Karach
did a
very
Shema
and Spinal
emotion.
Is
that true?
The Rav said that.
Yeah.
But again, he, the Rav said, his Taina was a good Taina. His claim, Karach, were all holy. He was right.
Yeah.
But he himself meant it for his own self-aggrandizement.
Oh.
So, yes, he deceived himself into thinking was good with Shem Shammai, but he really wasn't. So that's why it's so dangerous. Yeah.
How does Ayur Lishma work? Because if it's against the halacha, so how could it be that it's doing the right thing? Meaning, isn't the halacha supposed to be how it built in?
That's why Chaim Belozer says that Ayur Lishma is only permitted before Mount Torah, before Har Sinai. It's very difficult to say that because
you're right.
So you would have to say that either, according to Chaim Volozh, you have to say that they were Nevios, and therefore they had a special, dispensation which they received from God. But, Aveir Lishma, generally speaking, it's very difficult to know that it should be permitted, but all of us do it. Now we do it, but we do it on small things. For example, has anybody here ever missed a minyan because it would create a big problem at home? Some of you are lying.
What do you mean by big problem at home?
In other words, if you went to minyan now, right, this would seriously undermine your relationship with your parents, cause friction, or, cause the chil Hashem in the aspect that people think you're really frummed out of your gourd, something like that. Who's people have had this experience, right? We have all had this experience. So that's an, so you didn't go to shul, right? That was an Aveir Lishma.
Isn't minyan rabbinic and
whatever it is, it's course. It's not the same thing as having
the
relations. They're relatives.
No,
relatives.
You're doing a mitzvah. You keep it
yeah,
up.
Yeah, but
that welcome
is it's doichy kibrabe. It's doichy kibrabe. Going to minyan, it is. But we don't do it anyway, which is because we ourselves make these cheshbonim sometimes. So, everything is relative. You can't decide, okay, I'm not going to commit Aveir Lishma of murder. That's not within your purview to make a decision like that.
So you could just miss minyan for...
I didn't say you could just miss minyan. It can be a wrenching and agonizing decision, but it does happen, yes. Yeah.
So then it was shocking because you can't be able to call over there one side of Mitzvah.
It's not an Avera.
Oh.
It's not being kind of a mitzvah. When I say Avera Lishma, I meant not necessarily an Avera.
That's talking about when the doctor goes out.
Yeah.
So then, are we wrong to make such like?
No. Those are cheshbonos that even we can make, even the morons can make, right? The cheshbonos on a higher level, that's for special people to make. Okay, Abaytai, we'll stop here. That's it for the year, although it's hard to speak about a 2.5 week break as being
a year, a real vacation.
Oh, that's not true. I think I'm supposed to give time at the end of August. August 21st and 22nd.